But with that, I will dive right in. So in much of your writing, Dan, your target is the bipartisan consensus on immigration. What is that consensus, and what are the origins of that consensus?
So is this coming out well? Yeah. Okay. The origins of the contemporary consensus is that, quote, illegal immigration is a problem, and that it poses various sorts of threats: a fiscal threat, a criminal threat, especially after September 11th, a terrorist threat. And the consensus is that there are repressive enforcement measures that need to be taken to deal with that. But I should put that in a little bit of context. The context I put it in the book, and this is just like a very brief capsule history, but to understand the contemporary bipartisan war on immigrants, one really needs to understand this sort of racist population politics that's been at the center of this country from before its founding. First, with settler colonialism, which is a form of migration politics. It's prioritizing first the migration of British subjects, and then more European migrants more generally to the U.S. to dispossess indigenous people on their land as part of the project of westward expansion. The transatlantic slave trade and the coerced migration of enslaved African workers is also part of that population politics. I think very important, you know, 243 years ago today, when the Declaration of Independence was signed, two of the key complaints that the colonists had with the British Crown was, one, that the British Crown was interfering in migration, and in the colonists wanted more settlers, and the Crown was getting in the way. And two, that the British Crown was getting in the way with westward expansion and indigenous dispossession and genocide across the Appalachian Mountains. So those were two key things articulated very clearly in the Declaration of Independence that's published in full length on the back of the New York Times every July 4th, but that I don't recall ever learning as a kid. After the revolution, the U.S.'s first naturalization law is passed just a few years after, and it's very, very straightforward in terms of who's eligible for citizenship in this country. Free white persons. Very straightforward. And there's so much here, I'm going to skip past the Alien Sedition Act and things like that, and just the next key moment is really the era of Asian exclusion, initially targeting Chinese workers with the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. And this is an important moment to understand, because it gets at the root of the sort of contradiction that nativism is a result of. There's this conception of the free, economically independent settler, and that's defined by not doing certain types of menial, degraded, dependent work. But guess what? Like, we live in an economy and there was an economy at the time that required just that sort of work. And so you have people like enslaved Africans doing that sort of work. You have people like Chinese migrant workers who are coming to build the Transcontinental Railroad doing that sort of work. And they're seen as posing the Chinese and Asians, like enslaved black people and then free black people before them, are seen as posing a threat to white labor, because of the sort of labor that American capitalism is forcing them to do. And so the opposition to this bifurcated labor market is projected on to their like racialized bottom rungs of the segmented labor market, instead of against the American capitalist system as a whole. And so you have Chinese exclusion, and it's followed by other exclusions targeting almost the entirety of Asia, minus the Philippines, because they're colonial subjects, because the U.S. seized them, the Philippines, during the Spanish-American War. The next key period, just to give some important context here, is the national origins quota period, which begins in the 1920s. That both consolidates Asian exclusion, but also in this period when eugenics is really like defining national policy, both in terms of social science and policy making and popular culture. There are fitter family contests at state fairs all across the country, where families are putting themselves forward to have their genetic quality judged, like alongside livestock. This is the environment in the teens leading up to the 1920s. And so, you know, in the late 19th and early 20th century, you have sort of this like comprehensive whiteness defined against the Asian and also Black and you know also others. But then with the consolidation of Asian exclusion, then the nativists, especially on the East Coast, start to make these like patrician WASP nativists at the immigrant exclusion league, who are like these Harvard educated patrician eugenicists. They start to make all these very fine-grained distinctions amongst white people. And so like Italians, for example, are called the Chinese of Europe, or padrone, I don't know, is it padrone, padrone? This thing I've been reading, I haven't been saying it. Padrone coolies. And they're seen as occupying a similar, they're seen as such because they occupy the sort of labor they're doing. You know, there's this huge migrant surge from Europe, millions of people from Southern and Eastern Europe, Italians, Jews, others, coming to work in this booming industrial economy in the US. And they're racialized precisely because of the sort of work they're doing. And so in the 1920s, beginning in 1921 and then again in 1924, they put in place the system of explicitly racist national origin quotas that, I won't get into like the details of how it works, but the effect of it is not only that Asian exclusion is basically entirely made comprehensive and consolidated, but immigration until 1965, from 1921 to 1965, is overwhelmingly limited to people from England, Ireland, and Germany. And this is the period, by the way, that if you check out either what like Steve Bannon or Stephen Miller or Richard Spencer, when they're talking about immigration, this is the period that they want to return to. This is the period of the country. This is the period and the period before it of Asian exclusion. This is how white people came the right way. When you hear people say that today, my other answers are gonna be shorter, but this is the context answer. The last big piece of context is Mexican migration, because obviously, you know, for the time period that most people in this room have been alive, American nativism, anti-immigrant politics has been overwhelmingly defined by anti-Mexican politics. Not exclusively, but very much that has been at the center. And that is because of the creation of Mexicans as like the iconic, quote, illegal immigrant. How does that happen? Mexican migrants start getting recruited in large numbers in the early 20th century. Obviously, a lot of other Mexicans don't arrive but are incorporated into the U.S. after the U.S. seizes half of Mexico's territory during the Mexican-American War, but that's another story. And so you have booming Southwest agriculture. This is a key part of the story of U.S. westward expansion is the eruption and the growth of industrial agriculture in the Southwest, and Mexican migrant workers are being recruited to do that work. And it gets formalized during World War II with something called the Bracero Program, which is a guest worker program that through 1964 brings millions of Mexican guest workers into this country. Neither Mexicans nor other migrants from the Western Hemisphere are touched by these national origin quotas and other exclusionary laws. A lot of nativists would like to, but the growers, the agriculture interests are too powerful. And as the Dillingham Commission, which is the commission that lays the groundwork for the 1920s national origin quotas, put it, it's okay, the Mexicans are gonna return home after they work. I think the precise quote from the report that I read is something like, they're better suited as workers than as neighbors. And this, the assumption is they won't be neighbors. But the end of this capsule history is that in 1964, the Bracero program comes to an end. It comes to an end in part because of valid criticism from organized labor. It's an incredibly abusive program. In 1965, the national origins quotas come to an end, and we get this purportedly colorblind system. But what happens is that the end of the explicitly racist immigration system, which is a continuation of an immigration system that has been racist since the founding of the United States and before, that is accompanied by a huge reduction in opportunities for authorized Mexican migration. But there's this huge pattern of Mexican labor migration already in place. That labor migration continues, and it's criminalized. That is the origin of the Mexican as the like iconic illegal immigrant. And then maybe I'll say two more things on this, and then and so how does that? So that's how Mexican labor is criminalized. How does it enter the center of American politics? Well, it enters it because at the same time that Mexican labor is becoming criminalized, and all of a sudden the demographics of U.S. authorized migration are changing dramatically, whereas before, as I mentioned, it was almost exclusively Irish, German, English. All of a sudden, it's extremely heavily Asian. Nationalities that have been heavily restricted or barred for much if not most of U.S. history. And so this A, the demographic change, B, the criminalization of Mexican migration, has the poor fortune to accompany, to coincide with a massive restructuring of the American economy, as everyone in this room knows well. The crisis of the New Deal order, the rise of neoliberalism, the business assault on labor, and it's not just a scapegoating story. I have a somewhat more sophisticated argument in my book, but that is basically what happens. In response to an anti-immigrant movement that really takes organizational form for the first time in 1979, Republicans, especially starting in the 90s, Republicans and Clintonite Democrats alike, very much to protect neoliberalism and to accomplish some other things, but demonize undocumented immigrants as this criminal, fiscal, cultural threat. Clinton, in response to this nativist uprising in California, which is forming alongside Proposition 187, which would bar public undocumented immigrants in 1994 from accessing public services, Clinton begins to militarize the border. Pete Wilson, the Republican governor, runs, he's up for re-election that same year. He hitches his re-election campaign to Prop 187, and both win in a landslide. Tellingly, though, it's not Pete Wilson in California who first starts to demagogue against undocumented immigrants. It's Dianne Feinstein. And that's sort of like a microcosm of the story my book tells. So.
Yeah, so Bill Clinton is a very important figure in the story that you're telling.
Yeah.
He sort of personified, as lots of people know, the shifting tides within the party away from any remnant of New Deal liberalism. I think people sort of know that he was sort of draconian on immigration, but it's interesting the sort of convergence of the decline of New Deal liberalism and an increasingly hardline stance on immigration that Clinton takes. I found this when I was coming up with questions for you. The 1996 State of the Union is well known for the line, "The era of big government is over." But it also contained this passage not long after, just a few passages after that line. Clinton said, and I quote, "There are some areas that the federal government should not leave and should address strongly. One of these areas is the problem of illegal immigration. After years of neglect, this administration has taken a strong stand to stiffen the protection of our borders. We are increasing border controls by 50%. We are increasing inspections to prevent the hiring of illegal immigrants. And tonight I will announce I will sign an executive order to deny federal contracts to businesses that hire illegal immigrants." So this is, this is pretty fascinating. Him sort of gloating during the State of the Union, how right-wing essentially he is on immigration. So can you talk about this, the convergence of anti sort of big government liberalism and also this hardline immigration policy that Clinton is praising himself for pursuing?
Yeah, and if there are a lot of bad guys in the book, but Clinton is probably looms larger than most. And it's really interesting. There are memos that have been released that some of you have probably read from Clinton's advisor at the time, Rahm Emanuel, that very much makes it clear that he needs to, yeah Chicago. that very much make it clear that this whole Clintonian politics of triangulation and co-opting the conservative message to try to outflank them and diffuse their attacks is very immigration, anti-immigrant politics is very much a part of that, along with anti-welfare politics, along with the war on crime. And Rahm Emanuel even makes it explicit in one memo, and this was like a golden citation for my book, that basically to protect good relations with Mexico and NAFTA, essentially, I forget how he exactly describes it, we have to protect illicit cross-border commerce with Mexico, we have to crack down on the illicit cross-border commerce. And then in like parentheses, it says people and drugs. So it's very revealing. And Clinton also says, this is another quote from, I think, a radio address in 1993 or four, around then, we are a nation of immigrants, but we will not tolerate those whose first act upon entering this country is to break the law. So there's this notion, not only that immigrants are committing like violent crimes, which obviously comes to define Trump's anti-MS-13 crusade, but is very much present in the 90s. I highly recommend anyone who wants to spend a weird afternoon watching campaign ads from the mid-90s. It's all there. But also very much relatedly, that undocumented immigrants are inherently criminal because of the act of illegally crossing the border. And so, getting back to your actual question, this is a form of balanced budget nativism. Prop 187, which would bar public services to undocumented immigrants, and which is really the first explosion of the contemporary nativist movement that we're still living with today, very explicitly in the proposition's language defines the immigrant threat as simultaneously criminal and fiscal, and tellingly, welfare reform targets authorized immigrants, and it's really part and parcel of the racist welfare reform politics that targeted black mothers at the time, and also the racist war on crime that targeted young black men in particular at the time. So both welfare reform and these major law and order criminal justice bills from the 1980s through the 1990s target immigrants very explicitly. And the major anti-immigrant law of the time, the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigration Responsibility Act of 1996, IRA-IRA, is also very much a crackdown on so-called criminal aliens. And it's this critical law that links immigration enforcement and the criminal justice system together. So part of what I'm trying to do in my discussion of the 1990s is really connecting the story that I think a lot of people know about the repressive politics of the war on crime and of welfare reform in that era, and how those were used to bolster neoliberalism and to present a government that no longer did much to provide economic security for the people as providing a more visceral form of security, that the anti-immigrant politics of this era are very much a part of that, and the fiscal conservatism and law and order conservatism of it are fundamentally one and the same.
Yeah, and can you talk about what the human toll of that crackdown was? I mean, I think it's sort of easy to slip into maybe abstract, almost an abstract discussion of this, but this was really, I mean, this led to lots of people dying, lots of human misery that was completely unnecessary.
Yeah, in terms of the human toll, there are two things I think I would highlight. First, with the militarization of the border, which starts to happen, you know, before the 1990s, but really takes off in the form that we know it today in the 1990s, in, I believe, 1994 in El Paso, Texas, with a Border Patrol operation called Operation Hold the Line. It was originally titled called Operation Blockade, and that was seen as like a little too much, so they renamed it Hold the Line. And what happened at the time was that in El Paso and its sister city, Ciudad Juarez, in Mexico, there was a long-standing pattern of daily unauthorized commuting. It wasn't so much an entry point for people coming into the country to long-term migrate. These are sister cities that are essentially, you know, part of one mega city. I used to live in Juarez in college. And you know, people would just live in Juarez, they had family in El Paso, their employer was in El Paso, whatever. You could just walk, the Rio Grande is like not very strong there, there was a bridge there. You could just walk across the river in the morning and cross back through the authorized Mexican point of entry in the evening. And Sylvester Reyes, who's, I believe, the first Hispanic Border Patrol sector chief ever, he does something that people didn't think would be possible. He mobilizes an enormous number of Border Patrol agents to shut down unauthorized entry from El Paso and Juarez. And so it was seen as impossible for a long time. Securing, like truly securing the border, suddenly seems to everyone as possible. And once that starts to happen, that sets off a chain reaction, because the Clinton administration is very embarrassed because Reyes kind of does this on his own, and so they're like, okay, no, we're gonna do this all over the border. Janet Reno announces, the Attorney General at the time, announces the second operation modeled off of Hold the Line in San Diego just a month or two, I believe, before Prop 187 passes, called Operation Gatekeeper. And so basically, for years after, this process of shutting down the most popular points along the border for unauthorized entry with massive shows of Border Patrol force, this just gets repeated again and again and again along the border. And what happens is that it doesn't stop unauthorized immigration. It pushes migrants into crossing in ever more dangerous parts of the border. And the result of that, as I think everyone here probably knows well, is a huge increase in the number of people who die in the desert crossing the border. I don't have the numbers handy, but they're high. Another thing, this is not so much on this is on the human impact side, it has this very perverse effect, the militarization of the border, what sociologist Douglas Massey calls a caging effect, which is basically Mexican migrants who otherwise would have been circularly migrating, going to work in the U.S. for a year, two, three, whatever, and then returning to Mexico, decide to stay in the U.S. because they see that it's going to be so much harder to get back across. And so instead of decreasing the undocumented population in the U.S., what Douglas Massey, who's one of the top migration scholars in the country, has found is that it actually perversely had this caging effect and caused more undocumented immigrants to stay in the U.S. The other thing I would say in terms of the human toll is that, you know, with the war on crime and the war on immigrants both escalating and increasingly interlinking throughout the 1990s, you have this ever more efficient deportation pipeline that by the time Obama takes office, you know, links the point of arrest, you know, an undocumented immigrant getting booked into a local jail system directly into ICE. And that is what allows that seamless merger of the criminal justice system, the federal criminal justice system, the local criminal justice system, and the federal immigration enforcement system is what allows Obama to achieve record deportations and become the deporter in chief. So that's a human consequence that results in millions of deportations over the years and countless millions more terrified.
And where was the nativist right in these years? How did they help shape the debate at the national level, and what kind of effects did they have on the country's immigration policy?
Yeah, the story of the organized nativists is really wild, and it's like a big part of my book, and I don't think it's very well known at all. It's the organized nativist movement as we know it is founded by an ophthalmologist, conservationist, and abortion rights advocate named John Tanton from Michigan in 1979. He founds it's this moment of like a lot of people freaking out over overpopulation. The book The Population Bomb was published a few years prior, and there's this sense that like if we don't do something about it, poor people are breeding so much that we're not going to have it. It's just neo-Malthusianism. There's not going to be enough food. There's going to be mass famine and social chaos, etc. It's out of this milieu that John Tanton forms the Federation for American Immigration Reform in 1979. He goes on to found or play a role in founding every single other significant key nativist organization in this country that remains the key nativist organizations today. U.S. English, which is founded sometime in the 1980s, which unsurprisingly its goal is to make English the official language, something we've never had. The Center for Immigration Studies, which is their think tank, and Numbers USA, which is a extremely powerful grassroots mobilization tool that flood anytime there's an immigration bill that might lead to the legalization of undocumented immigrants, just floods Republican congressmen's persons' offices with calls and faxes and whatnot. There's a lot in this history, but I'll say two things that I think are most important. One is that they start out, you know, concerned about the environment, though it never makes much sense why, if they care about the environment, they care. Like, the environment's a global thing, so why does it matter where these people are? So it's always racist, but I do take them seriously that on some level they are caring about the environment. And the first director of FAIR, Roger Connor, is, and I take him at his word on this. I mean, I think he's a bit of a racist too, but he really does like try to reach out to Black and Hispanic Americans and sees immigration as a labor market threat, and he does recognize that there is anti-immigrant sentiment amongst Black and Hispanic Americans. After all, I think it's nearly half of Asian and Black voters in California vote for Proposition 187, and about a quarter or a third, I don't remember exactly, of Latinos do. So he's not wrong about that. But this key thing happens in the 1990s where, yes, there's anti-immigrant sentiment that's generally existing across the political spectrum. The radical right, the right wing, is the only place where there's a social and political basis for like red hot nativism. And they discover this through direct mail, which is obviously, as some people here probably know, you know, this key thing in the rise of the modern conservative movement. They try sending appeals to mailing lists for population and environmental groups, and they get some response. And then they try sending more kind of like culturally and racially coded messages to conservative mailing lists. And that's where their membership really blows up. So that's the beginning of this movement of the nativist movement firmly into the right-wing camp, which is still in process throughout the 90s. But by the 2000s, I mean, FAIR is hosting, FAIR is, and all these groups are deeply embedded within the new right-wing media system connecting AM talk radio and Fox News. FAIR is hosting, I don't remember what year it starts, this annual event called Hold Their Feet to the Fire, which is billed as that still exists today, the largest gathering of conservative talk radio in the country. So they really, in a few decades, move from a group that's really intentionally trying not to be partisan to a core facet of the right-wing culture war and media system. And the only other thing I'll say about this is that something that's really remarkable in the 1990s, really remarkable, is that extremely overtly racist anti-immigrant arguments are getting a really sympathetic hearing in the 1990s in a lot of very mainstream publications in a way that like does not actually happen today. It's really, really wild. Like Peter Peter Brimlow, who goes on in 1999 to found VDare, one of the major white supremacist websites, unsubtly named after Virginia Dare, who's said to be the first white child born in North America. He publishes his book. He's a National Review editor of some sort. He publishes a lengthy cover story warning about the illegal invasion in, I think, like 1992 or 93. And then in 1994, 1995, I believe, he publishes Alien Nation. And I believe it's Random House that publishes it. And it gets, and it's extremely racist. He says things like, you know, America's always been white at its core, and I believe that, you know, the people of this country have a right to insist on the, you know, the racial setup we have and the right to demand that it turn back to the way it was. And it gets extremely sympathetic reviews in The Atlantic, The New York Times. And this is also the period, of course, when, you know, the bell curve is being excerpted in the New Republic. Right. So that's something I'm, that's what I gotta say about that.
Yeah, so we covered the 90s pretty well. Let's talk about...
I can do 90s all day.
Let's talk about the Bush years. I think three things sort of stand out. You've got the rise of the war on terror. You got the emergence of comprehensive immigration reform as a kind of watchword in American politics. And then you have then the explosion of the modern day immigrant rights movement.
Yeah.
Can you take us through those years and what was happening to the bipartisan consensus in those years? What sort of effect did the sort of nascent immigrant rights movement have in pushing back against some of the nativist stuff coming out of Washington?
Yeah, a lot's happening there. So I'll just talk about some of it. Initially, the attacks of September 11th and the U.S.'s response sort of pushes immigration out of the center of the debate. But more consequentially, what it does is it makes immigration enforcement not just as a political matter, but like as a literal institutional matter, as a question of homeland security and the war on terror. So it gets subordinated to that, which means that that's the framework it's being addressed with. There's this amazing, I shouldn't use words like amazing, but the shocking, like, wow, Border Patrol strategy published a few years after September 11th, that's basically like, the Border Patrol, CPB's mission is preventing terrorists from entering the nation. Like, think about all the things CPB is supposed to do, and they're like, no, all of, like, our real goal is actually just preventing terrorists from entering the nation, even though no known terrorists has ever crossed the southern border and the 9/11 hijackers entered on visas. Never mind, that's their mission. But he's like, and the good news is we can only do this by getting better at our traditional mission of stopping illegal immigration across the border. And so you have this framework, which is very useful to politically in terms of a growing crackdown on undocumented immigrants. And then you also just have like loads of more funding. Just to give some context, these numbers are not going to be at all precisely accurate, so don't cite me. It goes from something like, the Border Patrol goes from something like 3,000 something, or maybe 4,000 in 1993 to nearly 20,000 today. So this whole period is like a massive, what we take as normal in terms of border security now was not that long ago very abnormal and not the reality. So that's a big part of it. And you also see increasingly by the mid 2000s this connection of the Muslim threat with the Mexican threat. Initially, interestingly, after 9/11, Republican, I forget the polls terminology, but like Republicans' positive feelings about Islam actually increased significantly immediately after 9/11. My argument is that what's happening there is that this popular anti-Muslim sentiment is getting channeled into the official channel of the war on terror. But when the war on terror becomes a total disaster that fails on all of its own terms, and in its terms, and I think we have to take them somewhat seriously because they're popular at the time, you know, are these neoconservative terms that this is not, we're not at war with Islam. You know, Bush visits a mosque 6 days after 9/11. We're not, this is not a war of vengeance. We're bringing democracy to the Muslim world. That's obviously not what was happening and not what happened. And so when Americans get disillusioned, that's when popular Islamophobia begins to really explode and starts to merge with longstanding anti-Mexican sentiment in the mid, the middle and late part of the last decade. So that's the 9/11 part. I'll cut that short. Comprehensive immigration reform. So there was a big immigration reform in 1986, IRCA, which legalized a few million undocumented immigrants. That was, wouldn't have happened if the nativist movement had the power it had today. It didn't have the power then. The nativist movement thought that the employer sanctions, i.e., you know, fines against employers who hire undocumented immigrants in IRCA, signed by Reagan in 1986, they thought that that would work in terms of deterring unauthorized migration. Didn't work. So by 2000, by the 2000s, by the Bush administration, we have, I think it's like 7-8 million, going up closer to like 11 million by the end of the decade, if I have the numbers right. And the goal is to do this thing called comprehensive immigration reform. That's the bipartisan establishment goal. That's a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants, increased guest worker programs for business, and increased enforcement for the nativists, including more border militarization. The thing is, and this will be a very familiar establishment problem, is that they don't get that the hardcore right-wing nativists will never vote for anything that includes legalizing undocumented immigrants. Never. Never. And they make that very clear, but like the establishment doesn't listen. So not only do they fail to get these reform measures passed, you know, year after year after year, in an attempt to placate the rising nativist right, they start passing standalone enforcement measures and taking standalone enforcement executive actions. But that doesn't placate the nativist right. That just moves, you know, as everyone says these days, that moves the Overton window on immigration further and further to the right. A case in point is the Secure Fence Act of 2006. Bush fails to get immigration reform, which would have included building a lot of border fencing, i.e. border wall. It fails, so Bush signs into law the Secure Fence Act, which builds hundreds of miles of fencing, the substrate of what is today, you know, Trump's border wall. Who votes for that? Hillary Clinton votes for that. Joe Biden votes for that. Barack Obama votes for that. And never do the nativists vote for reform. That continues under Obama. And this is where the contemporary immigrant rights movement really emerges. Actually, I'll go back a little bit. So in 2005, the nativist right has this huge victory where when the House in December of that year passes something called the Sensenbrenner Bill, which a lot of you might remember, which amongst other things would have criminalized merely being present in this country undocumented, which is not a criminal offense currently, nor has it been. It's a civil offense. This is a huge victory for the nativist right. George Bush at the time refers to it as a good step towards comprehensive immigration reform, which is like precisely the opposite of what it is. But this prompts a massive immigrant rights movement in 2006, as many of you will remember, including the historic May Day marches of that year, which I think brought up to a million people to the streets of Los Angeles. I was heavily involved in organizing the demonstrations that year in Oregon. And so that is the reaction to the nativist rights right at that moment that creates the immigrant rights movement as we know it today. And then returning to where that movement goes from here, I have to go back to the comprehensive immigration reform story, which is that Obama keeps pushing comprehensive immigration reform, and it's failing. He becomes the deporter in chief. He's deporting an enormous number of people through this program called Secure Communities and other measures. The DC immigrant rights establishment is standing by Obama and protecting them and saying, no, the problem is not Obama's. The problem is Republicans need to pass comprehensive immigration reform. But increasingly, local, more left, immigrant-led grassroots organizations, you know, their people are being deported. And it's not the DC, it's not the big DC groups, it's local organizations like the National Day Laborers Organizing Network who and Dreamers who push a fight against Obama, labeling him the deporter in chief. And they win some enormous victories. They win DACA, and they win significant limitations on who Obama is deporting. So that's that.
Yeah, we should wrap it up quickly, but I want to maybe ask one final question, because we should talk about Trump's policy at least a bit. You've laid out a lot of history here. What do you think is longstanding? What is uniquely inhumane in Trump's immigration policy? And I guess we could also talk about some glimmers of hope that we already have in the present, especially some polling that shows that the American public has never been more pro-immigrant, and also that it's become sort of a partisan issue. Democrats are more pro-immigrant than they've ever been.
Yeah, so the good news, I'll start with that, is that this is the beginning, we've already witnessed the beginning of the end of the bipartisan consensus behind the war on immigrants. This whole period in the 2000s, in the late Bush and Obama, and throughout the Obama administration, when the war on immigrants becomes an increasingly partisan issue, the consensus breaks up. And so now increasingly, the polling is remarkable. Americans are, as far as I can tell, never more pro-immigrant than right now. And so that's good. What's new and what's old? I think the best anecdote to explain what's new and what's old is it was last year in the midst of, you know, Trump's initial family separation crackdown. Jon Favreau, the Pod Save America host, who was an Obama speechwriter, tweeted some photo of either Mexican or Central American children in some sort of detention cage and was like, this is barbaric, you know, what this administration is doing. This is not us, this is not America, or something like that. And it turned out that those photos were taken under the Obama administration. Obama was detaining families together in disgusting, horrible, horrific conditions. Courts ruled that was illegal. And so when Trump wanted to crack down along the same lines, that involved separating families. How did he separate families? Well, he used a law that criminalizes unauthorized illegal entry into the country. Who had dusted off that law to start using it increasingly when it hadn't been used very much for quite a long time? Bush and Obama. You see the numbers if you look at the data for prosecutions for unauthorized entry and unauthorized reentry, those skyrocket under Bush and Obama. And so what Trump does in terms of using those prosecutions to separate families is a novelty, but it's a novelty that's deeply embedded within the bipartisan war on immigrants as it had been for decades. And so how new is Trump? I mean, that's like a question in my book's range. The Muslim ban is new in terms of compared to Bush or Obama, but it's very much in line with how American immigration policy was organized pre-1965. But I mean, overall, and this is not, I mean, he has caused like massive amounts of pain, fear, death, and I don't want to trivialize that in any way, but he has turbocharged this partisan polarization over immigration that began under Obama. And that polarization is a very good thing, because that consensus was a rotten, violent, racist one.
That's a good way to end it. Let's all give it a hand to Gavin.